Alrighty, we pass the basket in accordance with the seventh tradition, which states we're fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. I'm going to introduce the second speaker, also from the High Point Group in Largo, and it's Jerry.
Hi there, I'm Jerry Lobo, I'm an alcoholic. And it's good to be here. Thanks, Byron. Byron's a good friend of mine, but he is my second favorite Australian. My first favorite Australian is Nicole Kidman, of course. So, it's by God's grace, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, a loving sponsor and a lot of good friends. I haven't had to drink since the 30th of June, 1995, and for that I'm extremely grateful. It's really good to be here. This might shock you, but I am from India. And, you know, it's all about outsourcing, folks. at least till the next president. So, you know, just to tell you a little bit of my background, I grew up, I've got four sisters, my mom and dad, and, you know, my mom and dad are gone now, but there's no alcoholics in my family apart except me, and, you know, what I found out about myself and talking to other alcoholics is I always felt that I was one step behind the world. I've always felt that way until I got sober, and I can still feel that way today. But I grew up in Bombay. I grew up a mile from the Arabian Sea. You know, it was a really nice area, right on that coast, right on the coast there, is the big film industry. You know, so I went to school with a lot of the Indian film industry. I went to school with a lot of their kids, and you know, their kids got dropped off to school in chauffeur-driven cars. And then there was the rest of us who had to walk to school or ride our bicycles. And, you know, most kids accept it. It's a part of the environment, but not me. And I used to look at them and just, I used to just hate them, you know, and now, and hate them for being rich. And what I've come to realize, that's a part of my spiritual malady. You know, I'm right in the middle of paradise, and all I can find is what's wrong with me. And, you know, my other friends had a great life. And I always wanted someone else's parents, and I wanted someone else's money, and I've always had a really good relationship with a higher power right from the time I was a kid. And I remember sitting in church. Every school in India has a big cathedral-like church, and I remember sitting in church all by myself and asking God, you know, just what's wrong with me? You know, here I am. I've got everything that I ever need. You know, I've got, sometimes in most cases, I've got more than other kids, and I still just feel like I don't have enough. I feel like I want to run away. And, you know, I never put that two and two together till many years later. I picked up my first drink when I was about 14 years old, and Byron kind of mentioned it. And when I took that first drink and it went down, I went from zero to stud in 60 seconds. You know, I felt awesome. It completed me. That first drink completed me. It did for me what God does for me today. You know, and all those demons that were in my head and going around, you know, they just went away, and I felt normal. I felt good. I could talk to people. You know, I just instantaneously felt good looking, and it was a great feeling. And when you have a feeling like that, you know, you want to chase it. And that started a trend for me. My parents didn't drink. I mean, my parents were social drinkers, and my dad opened a bottle of wine on a special occasion for Easter or Christmas. And I couldn't possibly tell them that every day of my life's a special occasion. So my dad used to uncork this bottle of wine for Christmas and give everyone a little bit of wine and then put the cork back. And during the period from Christmas to Easter, I started changing wine into water. And, you know, and, And when Easter came around, my dad used to take that bottle, dust it off, uncork it, and he used to taste a little, and he used to look at my mom, and my mom's name was Joyce, and he used to say, "Joyce, I think we got a bad bottle of wine here." You know, and that's how I started drinking, and then it got progressively worse. And you know, everything that comes with the destruction of everyone around you. And what I've come to find out, you know, when I drink, is I hurt the people closest to me, and who suffered were my four sisters and my mom and dad, and I treated them like crap. You know, I started stealing from them, and coming home late, and you know, just causing them a lot of heartache. And they were simple people. You know, my dad finally asked me when I was 19 years old. He says he gave me an opportunity to come to the U.S. To study, and that was his way of trying to help me out. You know, they were simple people. They didn't know what the disease of addiction and alcoholism was. So like every good family, what he did was he went into his life savings, and he sent me here. And I was really excited. It was at the time when Saturday Night Fever was coming out, and you know, and Greece, and it was great. And I saw all this, and I had traveled some, but I had not been to the United States. And I saw these movies, and I thought, wow, you know, that's what America's all about, you know. I saw Olivia Newton-John in Greece, and I said, I'm going to go to. I couldn't wait to come to America and date a white woman, you know, because I, and having dated a white woman, that's a different meeting in itself, but I came to America, and I, and there were no parents, there was no supervision, and I don't know about you guys, but you know, if you give me a lineup of 10 people to choose roommates from, I instantaneously choose the alcoholics. And so I got these two guys as roommates, and all this money is coming in from abroad, and I'm paying their rent, and I'm paying their girlfriend's rent, and you know, we're just having a great time. And I went to the school where there were a lot of foreign students initially. And so we, you know, we all got together. It was like the United Colors of Benetton, you know, all of us. And we used to have a real good time. We used to go out, and we used to pretend we couldn't speak English. And when you can't speak English, it has its plus and minuses. But people used to come up to us and say, "Welcome to America." And I just want to share a little thing. If someone can't speak English, speaking louder and slower to them doesn't make them understand English. But it was free beer and chicken wings for the foreigners. And so we still have a great time. But my drinking was harder than anyone of my friends. And, you know, they started keeping away from me because I used to stay on and get into fights and come home really late. And then go back to school the next day. And, you know, when you go to bed at 3 o'clock in the morning and you're drunk at 7 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, it wasn't a fun sight. And I did everything that doctor's opinion said. I used to have so much remorse in the mornings. I used to wake up and, because I knew I was fooling my parents as to what was happening. You know, I've been always a good student, so at least my studies were good, but the lifestyle was just terrible. And I'm writing back home saying everything's great, and I used to look at that guy in the mirror and said, "Man, I, what's going on with you?" You know, I hated myself, and then I made that promise. Well, today when I come home, I'm gonna do something different. I'm going to do my homework, and I'm gonna watch TV, and I'm gonna cook. And come 5 o'clock in the evening, my roommates used to say, "Hey, Jerry, you want to go for a couple?" And before I could even answer, something in me said yes, and I used to go there for that couple, and the next thing I know, it's 2 o'clock in the morning again. You know, I know you guys can relate. You know, what happened? The doctor's opinion had made so much sense to me about the obsession and the craving, you know, and I did it time and time again, and that's how I live my life. I'm going to school, I'm doing decently with my grades, and then I say, well, you know, my life's just not going well. If I get married, That'll really solve the problem. I hadn't seen an Indian woman in a long time since I was here. I saw them, but I really, not in close quarters. I'm sitting at the campus in college, and I see this Indian girl walk across campus, and I'm into signs, so I thought it was a sign from God. So I stalk her for about 3 months, and and we got married, and I did, and I'd like to say it was awesome, but that started the 6 worst years of her life, and I honestly mean that. You know, what I sold her on was a person that only existed in my mind, you know, a guy that only existed in my mind. I sold her on a person who was going to support her and love her and, you know, provide for her, and that, I really did want to do all that, but I just couldn't deliver, you know, and the best of intentions. And of course, as you know, things just the same thing happens. You know, I'm going to, I'm going to these bars with my friends, and you know, coming home late at night, just having a good time, just getting drunk all the time, losing jobs. By then, we had graduated from college, and you know, right out of school, I got a really good job. And since I had to drink on Friday nights, and I just couldn't make it into work on Saturdays, I went to my boss and I told him it was against my religion to work on Saturdays. That doesn't work really well. And of course, within the 90 days, he told me why he needed me to work on Saturdays. And of course, I lost that job. But this is what happened in my marriage, you know. And I used to get drunk. When I was drunk, I used to hide our bills. And when I was sober, I couldn't find the bills. So if you can't find the bills, you don't have any bills. And that's how I lived. And it was just a really bad situation. You know, my ex-wife really tried to help me out. And midway through the marriage, she drew the line in the sand and said, you know, if you ever get a DUI, I'm out of here. And of course, the fear of losing somebody or something, you know, never phases an alcoholic. I don't know about you guys, but it never phased me. And besides, an Indian woman never leaves an Indian man. You know? I'm here to tell you that's wrong, folks. They will dump your ass in a heartbeat. So it was I'm trying to fast forward. I'm trying to get through this. 10th of June, 1995. I'm doing my own thing. It's a Saturday night. I just went out to see the boys. You know, the wife's at home. Unbeknownst to me, that every time I went out drinking, she used to call 49th Street, you know, just to see if I was in there. Because it was really, really bad. And it was 2 o'clock in the morning. I was really plastered. I got into my truck and I started heading home. And after about 5 minutes, I realized I was heading the wrong way. So I turned around on US 19, and I started heading back the right way, and I can swear up to today there was a road on the side of US 19, and I turned on that road, and there was no road, and I hit the curb, and the truck got stuck in the ditch, and you know, it's a bad place to be on a Saturday night, and when you're drunk, and I'm trying to get the truck out of the ditch. It's in reverse, and there's grass and mud just flying all over the place, and a friendly Clearwater cop comes to help me, and he knew I was drunk, and when I drink, I'm a happy drunk, so I'm talking to the cop, I'm laughing, I'm joking, and I'm asking him how his family's doing, I'm patting him on the back. Cops don't like being patted on the back, and so he's giving me the sobriety test, and I'm thinking nothing of it. But suddenly then he leans over and he goes, "Officer needs assistance." And before I know it, another cop, Clearwater cop, pulls up. And it was at that time when dashboard cams weren't, they were just coming out. They were still using the big camcorders. I don't know. If anyone graduated from DUI school here, you'll remember that. Way back when. They had the camcorders, so he steps out of the thing and then he starts filming me while I'm taking the sobriety test. And it was kind of funny because reality started setting. I knew what was going to happen. And real quick, I I calmed down real fast. Of course, they put the cuffs on me, and I did what macho men do when they're in trouble. You know, macho men do two things. They either call mom, or they start crying. Guess what I did? I'm bawling my eyes out on US 19. 29 years old, nothing to show for. I got a wife sitting at home, and here I am. And they took me to jail. I was terrified. I'd never been to jail before. And they put me in the cell with this guy. He must have seen me coming a mile away. I was just terrified. And he came up to me and said, you're going down, man. And then he, don't believe me, this is true. And then he goes, they're going to put you away for a long, long time. And I'm thinking Midnight Express, right? I'm going to be the warden's girlfriend in the morning. So anyway, they left me out of jail. A friend of mine bailed me out. My wife wouldn't even take my calls. And I walked back home, and I got into the house. And just like she had promised, she was sitting on the couch with her little suitcase packed, and I walked in, and she walked out, and the last thing she said to me was, "I'm not going to let you kill yourself, and I hope you take care of yourself, and good luck." And that was the last thing she said. She never returned to that house again, and it was a bad time in my life, you know. And my whole world crashed in on me that day. My sisters were down from Canada that day, and my youngest sister took the Yellow Pages at that time, and she called Alcoholics Anonymous for me. The guy on the helpline started talking to me, and of course, I started talking back, and I wanted to get as much as I could back to him to make him understand that she had just left a good man. And when I stopped to take a breath, he jumped in, and he says, "Well, there's an 8 o'clock meeting right down from where you live," and he hung up on me. And so I went for my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on the 11th of June, 1995. Did not want to be here at all. I absolutely did not want to be here. I just figured if I do a few weeks of meetings, my wife will come back. So I went to the meeting. I sat down. They said, "Are there any newcomers?" There were a couple of people who put up their hands, so I thought that was a cool thing to do. So I put up my hand and I said, "Hi, I'm Jerry. I'm an alcoholic." And of course, everyone clapped. And when you say you're an alcoholic, the whole room talks to you. And this guy looked at me and he said, "We're so happy you're here. You're the most important person in the room." And I remember thinking to myself, "You're damn right I am." So the meeting continues. At the end, they said, "Anyone want a white chip?" I said, they picked up the white chip, so I went right up behind them. I love talking, so I picked up a white chip. I thought I'd get to give a little speech there. And I said, "I just want you to know that my wife is gone, just left for a few weeks. But when she comes back, I'm going to come back and give you folks this white chip, because I don't want to think that I'm taking your property." And everyone looked at me and said, "Keep coming back." And I've since realized what "keep coming back" means. It means you need AA more than you think you need AA. I'd like to tell you that I stayed sober for the next couple of weeks, but I didn't. And if there's anyone new or was having a hard time, this is not the way to stay sober in the beginning. Every day after that, for the next 2 weeks, I went to an 8 o'clock meeting, and right after the meeting, I went to the bar I used to drink at. And that's just the way it happened for me. And I'm going 8 o'clock meeting, bar, 8 o'clock meeting, bar. And then about on the 29th of June, 1995, I had just come back from an AA meeting, and it was almost like Cheers. You know, all the people my friends in the bar wanted to know what happened at A&A that night. And I'm sitting down next to a friend of mine, and she was from Jordan, and she was just going through a divorce, and my wife had just left, so I thought we had a future together. It was 2-for-1 that night, so I ordered 4. I had just come back from an AA meeting, and I remember it like it was yesterday. And those 4 rum and cokes were sitting on the bar. They had little limes in them, little stir sticks. And, you know, God finds the worst time to get you sober, doesn't he? And I'm sitting there, had not even touched them, I had squeezed those limes, I had stirred those little suckers. They were sitting there. I'm talking to my friend here. You know, I was greasing the skids in AA jug and I was doing the footwork. I'm telling her about this AA meeting that I had just come from. And we're talking about this AA meeting, and she looks at me and says, are you allowed to drink when you go for those meetings? That was my moment, you know, and I look at her and I say, no. I've been fooling those people for the last 2 weeks. And I stepped down from that bar, and I've never had to pick up a drink since, folks. You know, God's impact on me was sudden. I don't know what happened, you know, it just did, and that's how God works. He just does. If you look back on your own sobriety, we all have that one microsecond in our lives that something different happens. You know, mine was about 9:30 on that Saturday or whatever night it was, when I just was stupid enough to allow God's grace to come into my life, and I got sober. I went home and I never wanted to drink again, but I didn't want to be an AA either. And for the next year and a half, I'd like to tell you I was a stellar AA, but I wasn't. And I just did kind of, I mouthed off AA, and they told me to get a sponsor, and I got a sponsor. And thank God for loving sponsors who stick with you even through anything and everything. And I'm working the steps, and I'm helping out, I'm making coffee, but I'm just doing it superficially and not wanting to drink. And it's a bad thing when you don't drink and you're not doing anything else in AA. You get to a point where you're stark raving sober. And a year and a half had gone by and I was pretty crisp. You know, I'm sitting at meetings and I'm hating people. I'm hating people because they're sharing the same damn thing over and over again. But I'm sober, I go home and at night I wake up in sweat, you know, in sweat, because I know that I'm not doing this the right way. I know I'm being dishonest, and you know this weight comes over me in the middle of the night, and this voice shows up and saying, "They're gonna find out, Jerry. They're gonna find out who you really are. You know, what are you doing about it?" And I'm doing nothing. You know, I'm just mouthing it off, and I'm talking about the steps and the big book, and I'm sponsoring people. And some of those guys are still sober, which tells me there is a God, you know. And then when I was about a year and a half had gone by, and Bill, my sponsor, I was talking to him outside one of a meeting, just talking nonsense as usual. And mid-sentence, Bill just turned around and started walking away. It kind of frosted me a little bit, because how dare he do that, right? I put my hands on my hips and I yell out to him, I said, "Apparently, you don't have time for my problems." Don't ever say that to a sponsor. Bill, this is what I saw. Bill's body kept moving forward, but his head spun around a couple of times. And before I knew it, he was right in my space, you know. And this little 5'5" man was now 6'1", and he was looking eye to eye. He told me, he said, "I hope you haven't been telling people you've been in recovery this time." He says, "Because you haven't." He says, "All you've been is a dry drunk." He says, "And if you continue doing and living the way you have, Jerry," he says, "I don't care how much you achieve, you'll always be a loser." He says, "But I know how you can be a winner if you let me help you." And you know, the grace of God one more time penetrated me, you know. It broke me down, and I just broke down, you know, and I hugged him, and I cried. I cried like a baby that night, and I recommitted to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. Do you know you can recommit to AA at any time? It's a beautiful thing, and I recommitted to Alcoholics Anonymous, and we started working those steps, you know, and we went through those steps. Every week we went through one step, and we wrote the fourth and fifth steps, and I'd just like to go real quick and take you through the steps the way I experienced them. at a high level. And steps 1, 2, 3, you know, I'm powerless over alcohol. You know, it's my inability to quit drinking. You know, it's I can drink just fine. It's my inability to quit drinking. When I take the first drink, the decision to take the second drink is made for me without my permission. I never understood that, you know, and as long as if I keep away from that first drink, I never have to worry about making that decision. And steps 2 and 3, I always had a really good relationship with a higher power, and the insanity they're talking about is not clinical. They're talking about the fact that after periods of sobriety, I forget what happens to me when I pick up a drink, and I go out and pick up a drink again. And that's insane stuff. And Bill brought it to my attention because I never drank every day. I was a binge drinker, and he always told me, he says, remember those periods of time where you were not drinking? What made you drink again after you? Did you forget what happened when you drank? Ah, insanity. The third step, I surrendered as best as I could. And what I did when I surrendered was I was surrendering. I was making a decision to work steps 4 through 9. You know, it's just a willingness. And I've always had this really good, deep relationship with God. So for me, I didn't really want to go back to where I came from. I mean, I really didn't. There was so much mess in my life. I really wanted to do something. And I started writing, you know, and I started writing on that fourth step. And for me, a lot of the uproar in my life was around women and relationships. And for me, it was not finding out why I had those 10 relationships. It was finding out why I had that one relationship 10 times. Because if I don't figure that out, I start doing that in AA. You know, I start doing that in AA and the behavior doesn't change. I'm just sober. And I started writing that down, and I did that fifth step with Bill, and he made me do exactly what the fifth step said. Admitted to God, to myself, another human being, and I went and I sat and he said, I want you to do exactly what the fifth step says. So I went to St. Catherine's and I sat down there with my fifth step. There was no one in the church. It was kind of scary because all the statues seemed to be coming off the pedestals there. And I said, hi God, this is Jerry. And I read God my fifth step, and it was a wonderful feeling. And then I went home and I sat in front of a full-length mirror and I told myself who I was with my fifth step. And it wasn't too hard because I always liked looking at myself. You know, alcoholics love looking at themselves. So. And then I went and I sat down with Bill and we went through that fifth step, and what a freedom there was, you know. And I told that man everything about me. You know, I've had two sponsors in recovery, and I'm so glad two men know everything about me. It's a very freeing feeling. And then I did steps 6 and 7. A lot of it came out of my fifth step. And, you know, that's something I do every day because I feel the 6 and 7 are so important to me because that's what keeps me from my relationship with God. You know, it's my shortcomings and my defects. And then steps 8 and 9, and my mother was sick. My mother was dying at that time. She was terminally ill. Bill had not seen his mother. His mother had not seen him sober. And he wasn't going to let me do that. Thank God for loving sponsors again. And he said, it's time to go back home. And he was talking about India. And I didn't want to do it. I was so full of fear. And I came up with every excuse in the book. You know, I can't get vacation. I'll call your boss. I can't afford the ticket. You can put it on my credit card. You know, he never let me go. He never let me get that excuse in. And I took that long trip. And I sat down with Mom and I talked to her. And I made amends. And she hugged me, you know. She wrote a letter to Bill. She didn't know anything about recovery. She didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. But she wrote a letter to Bill, and she said, thank you for taking care of my boy. You know, a mother's love, man. There's nothing like it. And I sat down with my family while I was there, and I and I talked to each one of them. And my dad, you know, my dad's always been my hero, and he was a quiet man. He was a very smart man. And I sat down and I talked to him, and I had this big long thing, and he just listened to me. And after I was done, he looked at me and said, "Yeah, you were a bit of an inconvenience." You know, and we both just started laughing at that, and you know, and I healed, and I had stolen so much money from them, and I'd stolen their stuff, you know, and I stole their stuff when I didn't need to steal. And I sat down with my four sisters and I made amends to them. You know, I came back from India a free man, you know, and I truly believe we all have to come home. And that's where our freedom comes. You know, wherever home is, home could be, you know, paying the IRS the 50 grand you owe them. You know, home could be talking to those children that you abandoned for all those years while we were out there. But when you come home, that's where the freedom is, you know. And I came back and I was free. I had done the deal, you know. And I go back since Mom and Dad died, and I went back and I went to that cemetery, that little cemetery that probably no one here will ever go to. And I put my, you know, my 4-year and my 13-year medallions there, you know, a gift from Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's been an incredible ride for me. And I came back to the U.S., and I still had a lot of amends to make. And I had some student loans that I was pushing back to the right because I figured if I waited long enough, they'd forget that I owed them money. But Bill explained to me the difference between a loan and a gift. And I wrote out checks for about 5 years, you know, but it was a great feeling. I got to pay back the loans. Steps 10, 11, and 12, and every night and throughout the day, I'm well aware of my behavior. You know, when you're in tune, you really don't have to think hard when you offend someone or you step on someone's toes. And you know, I'm well aware of that, and I try to make amends immediately. And at night, I hit my knees, and in the morning I hit my knees, but at night I hit my knees, and I ask God for the courage to do better the next day. Because sometimes I hold you to a standard that's way above what I could ever hit. And when you can't meet that, you know, I just, I get upset. And my humanness. I love prayer and meditation. It's been so powerful in my life, you know. What comes to mind when I talk about prayer and meditation is that line from the ninth step promises, "We will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us." And if you're quiet and if you're listening, when you're in the heat of battle and you hear that small voice that says, "Back off," and I listen to that, it always works out well, you know. And that's what meditation does for me. It helps me to kind of get a sense of what my higher power sounds like. We all have different higher powers, but that's what I do, you know. I've got a sense what my higher power sounds like, and that feeling, and it's an amazing feeling. And I come to step 12, and I've always believed that for those of us that much is given, much is expected. You know, we're all blessed. We're here, we're sober, and I love sponsoring guys, and I take the guys through the steps, and it's the biggest reward, you know, for me. And I do service work, and I hope everyone is registered for the convention coming up in a couple of weeks. But I take a meeting into the Salvation Army, and I talk to those kids, and it's a good feeling to see some of those kids, you know, at meetings. My life is phenomenal. You know, I had so many wonderful things have happened in my life. You know, I'm running out of time, so I really can't get into it. But I'll tell you one little story before I leave. I went back to this little village in India where my dad was born. This village got electricity in 1972. That's how little it was. And before I left, I got on the website to GSO, and I found out there was a little meeting there. I was really excited. So when I got there, I was searching for this meeting, and I couldn't find it. And I suddenly turned the corner, and I just see this big banner. You know, the church was the Savior of the World Church, and the group was the Savior of the World Church of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just stood there and I just wept. You know, because if you don't believe there's a God, when you see a little AA meeting on the other side of the world, you know, you know that God's working just fine. And I went for this meeting and I didn't speak the language, because in India there's so many different languages that if you go 200 miles, they'll be speaking a different dialect. But I went to that meeting. It was just like being at my home group. You know, and I sat down and I just absorbed the energy, and I was doing AA in India. It was awesome. And during the meeting, of course, in that part of the world, they serve you tea, and this guy comes out with a tray of sandwiches, and it was awesome. I went back next day just for the food. It was really special. And at the end of the time, my time there, I asked them if I could take a picture of that little AA room, and they were gracious enough to let me do that. And I took a picture of that room and I sent it to the Grapevine, and they published it. You know, and it was awesome. That's my most special copy of that Grapevine, the one that I got from India. You know, my life is truly amazing. It's not perfect, but it's amazing. Everything that I've ever wanted, if I only let it go, it's mysteriously found its way back to me. You know, as long as I'm willing to let God do the work and me do the footwork. So I'm almost end of time. I don't know much, folks, but I know three things for sure. One is that we've got an amazing God. Two is that if I don't pick up the first drink, there's absolutely no way I can get drunk. And three, if you work and live these steps, you'll have an amazing life. Thanks so much for having me.